Good morning, everyone. We're here at Beyond the Stethoscope podcast, focused on hospice palliative care. And today, I would like to introduce you to Kathy McEwen, who is one of the nurse consultants for the North Simcoe Muskoka Hospice Palliative Care Network. Welcome, Kathy.
Good morning, Linda. How are you?
I'm good. How are you doing?
Pretty good, thanks.
So I guess we'll jump right in. I know that the journal article that you're going to be reviewing today is a fairly heavy article to read. So I'm going to be appreciating the fact that you'll be breaking it down for us today. So what is the actual journal article that you're going to be reviewing today?
So the article I'm reviewing today is called Heart Failure, a Palliative Medicine Review of Disease, Therapies, and Medications with a Focus on Symptom Function and Quality of Life. It is from the Journal of Pain and Symptom Management. It's volume 39 from May 5th, 2020. It's been produced by Carolyn McGinty, who is a physician, Derek Leong, who is a pharmacist, Andrea Weiss, who's a physician, Jay McIver, who is an RN, Ebru Kaya, he is an MD, Bachelor of Science, Lindsay Hurlbert is an MD, Valio Balia is also an MD, Heather Ross, also a physician, and Kirsten Wentland, who's a physician.
And can you tell us why you actually chose this article?
Well, first of all, it was Canadian, even though it does have American input, but it has been, came from, you know, all of these people are affiliate with the University of Health Network in Toronto and U of T. And so that was one plus for me. And the other fact was that I do see patients with heart failure. Unfortunately, I often see them closer to end of life when they're like hours to days left of living. We don't really get these referrals early. So I was hoping that this article might give some insight and help me sort of focus on, you know, having physicians maybe look at this and be more accepting of the fact that people with chronic life-limiting illnesses that are terminal would benefit from palliative care earlier on than at end of life. So I was hoping that this article would give me some insight into that.
Okay, and can you actually tell us what is the focus of this article?
So the review of this article is a review of heart failure. It outlines current therapies and their effects and symptoms on symptoms, their hospital admission rates, their exercise performance, health-related quality of life, and survival. They also discuss some of the pharmacological interactions, and they highlight precautions to be taken commonly used palliative care medications. So the overall focus of this review is to equip palliative care clinicians with information to make evidence-based decisions while managing the balance between optimal disease management and patient quality of life.
So, and could you discuss with us what heart failure actually is?
So heart failure, it's a common clinical syndrome. It affects more than 23 million people worldwide. It results from an impaired filling or ejection of blood from the ventricles. So heart failure can be caused by a structural or a functional disorder because of disease of the myocardium or the pericardium or the endocardium, heart valves or vessels by metabolic disorders. So this article, though, is going to focus on the disease management of left ventricular heart failure because of left ventricular dysfunction rather than valvular or pericardial. So it's just looking at the heart muscle itself in the left ventricle, and that's where this heart failure is focused on.
So Kathy, can you describe the course of the disease and the prognosis related to heart failure?
I'm just going to back up for a minute. About heart failure, there are two components to this. So left ventricular dysfunction, it's categorized as they categorize it by ejection fractions. So the left ventricle, heart failure, they have two different ones. One is called heart failure reduced ejection fraction, which many of us may remember as systolic heart failure, and heart failure with a preserved ejection fraction, which is diastolic heart failure. So these are people who basically greater than 50% ejection fraction, or at least a normal ejection fraction, who are the heart failure PEF, And the people with the heart failure reduced ejection fraction or systolic heart failure, they have a less than 40% ejection fraction. So heart failure reduced ejection fraction is characterized by an increased left ventricular volumes and a reduced ejection fraction, whereby heart failure preserved ejection fraction is a clinical syndrome in which patients have symptoms and signs of heart failure, but normal to near, you know, left ventricular ejection fraction. So people who have heart failure reduced ejection fraction, they basically are having pump problems with their heart for some reason. It's a structural problem. And they are the ones that they have reduced, they're like less than 40%. Whereas people with heart failure preserved ejection fraction, these people are, they are, have multiple comorbidities, and often their heart failure is not what brings them into hospital. It's often one of their other comorbidities, such as hypertension, like, as you know, problems that they're having with other issues with health. Anyway, I will move on then to the course of this disease and its prognosis. So generally, heart failure is a progressive disease. It has periods of stability punctuated by episodes of clinical exacerbation. Predicting future events and anticipating the transition to an advanced disease is difficult, and the median time from onset to symptomatic disease to death has a wide range. Advanced disease is often characterized by high symptom burden. These patients often have dyspnea, fatigue, depression, anxiety, insomnia. They have decreased functional function, and they have pain and poor cognitive function are all symptoms commonly experienced by patients with heart failure. The strongest predictor for quality of life is the presence of physical symptom burden and advanced disease. So what they have found with a lot of these people, they have a higher symptom burden, and they also often have a lot of depression, and as well as lower spiritual well-being, which is greater than those patients that we see who have advanced cancer. So they're worse off sometimes than people that we see with that are cancer patients. So the existence of comorbidities are advanced age and frailty impacts the variability of symptoms and disease course. So multiple comorbidities can also amplify these symptoms. They can complicate the management and shorten prognosis. The management of contributing factors and comorbidities in heart failure preserved ejection fraction population is particularly important, as they have significant impact on the clinical course and the most subsequent hospitalizations in patients with heart failure. Preserved ejection fraction are often not because of their heart failure. The most common comorbidity for heart failure preserved ejection fraction patients are their hypertension, lung disease, coronary artery disease, atrial fib, obesity, anemia, diabetes, kidney disease, and sleep apnea. Almost 10% of patients with heart failure will die within 1 month of hospitalization for heart failure exacerbation, and yet some patients will live for decades. In a retrospective study, Shaw et al. Demonstrated a median survival rate of 2.1 years after hospitalization for heart failure in patients aged 65 years and older. Patients' prognosis is influenced by their age, their sex, their race, and cause of cardiomyopathy, which is the cause of their left ventricular dysfunction. The following clinical scenarios each account for approximately one-third of deaths in patients with heart failure, such as progressive pump failure, sudden death, and sudden death during episodes of clinical worsening. So predicting mortality in patients with heart failure is a challenge because of unpredictable disease course. There are many prognostication tools, although many of these tools have been developed, few have been externally validated and are often inaccurate when patients have advanced disease and are at end of life. The most widely validated tools are the Seattle Heart Failure Model. However, both have been shown, and the Heart Failure Survival Score. Both of these models have been shown to demonstrate only modest discrimination. In addition, the Seattle Heart Failure Model has been shown to overestimate prognosis in a small retrospective study of patients with heart failure referred to palliative. The Seattle Heart Failure Model uses 20 variables in that model to determine prognosis, which include age, sex, their left ventricular ejection fraction, the NYHA class, serum sodiums, uric acid levels, cholesterols, and the use of heart failure medications and devices to calculate a risk score for patients with which predicts 2 and 5 years survival rate. The heart failure survival score includes 7 variables, which include ischemia, cardiomyopathy, the presence of intraventricular delay on an EKG, left ventricular ejection fraction, resting heart rate, mean blood pressure, oxygen consumption, and serum sodium to risk stratify patients into three different categories of high risk, medium risk, and low risk, and estimate a composite outcome of death. Basically, they did another study in Europe. It was called the Meta-Analysis Global Group in the Chronic Heart Failure, which was sort of termed MAGIC score below. It showed a better accuracy than the Seattle Heart Failure Model, but basically they added a BNP, which is a blood test for heart failure, and found that it was shown to improve. But prognosis still is very difficult to make. So really none of these tools can accurately identify those with a prognosis on a scale of months, which is most useful for allocating patients into a hospice or a palliative care unit. So it's really difficult to prognosticate patients with heart failure. It is worth distinguishing though between heart failure preserved ejection fraction and heart failure reduced ejection fraction, as their disease courses and prognostic expectations do vary. The prognosis for patients with heart failure preserved, which is the ones with who are elderly, greater than 65 years of age, have multiple comorbidities, who are usually, they have the diastolic heart failure. These people, so their prognosis for these patients, it's even more poorly defined than that of patients with heart failure reduced ejection fraction. So although populations-based data has shown similar outcome in patients with heart failure preserved ejection fraction and heart failure reduced, a large meta-analysis observed a lower mortality rate was seen in heart failure preserved ejection fraction patients. But the proportion of cardiovascular and non-cardiovascular deaths among patients with heart failure preserved ejection fraction have varied along trials and epidemiological studies, with higher proportions of non-cardiovascular deaths in population-based studies, likely because heart failure PEF or preserved ejection fraction represents a heterogeneous group of conditions, meaning that they have lots of different issues, such as multiple comorbidities. Several studies have evaluated the difference in the morbidity between patients with heart failure reduced ejection fraction and heart failure preserved ejection fraction. This has included a focus on a rate and frequency of heart failure hospitalizations, symptom burden, exercise capacity. Overall, it has been determined that patients with heart failure preserved ejection fraction have a morbidity burden equivalent to that of patients with heart failure reserved ejection fraction. So basically, heart failure is heart failure. People who, it doesn't really matter what their ejection fraction is, you can't, it's not a prognostic tool. It's just where they're at, the type of heart failure that they have. People are going to die of heart failure, and it doesn't really matter which one they have, but it's just different in their treatments and how their the availability of treatment for these people. Heart failure reduced ejection fraction, people who have systolic heart failure, these people have lots of treatment modalities from medications to non-pharmacological treatments, whereas people who have heart failure preserved, which is the diastolic heart failure, those people who have multiple comorbidities, often other issues that they have, health problems, are what bring them into hospital or are what often put them into heart failure or will exacerbate their heart failure. They have really no treatment. They have loop diuretics and they have MRAs, which is, I believe, aldosterone, if I go look, but it's spironolactone, excuse me, I'm sorry, it's spironolactone, and which is an MRA classified drug, and loop diuretics are basically the only treatments available for these people. In other things that I looked at beyond this article, basically they said that there is no proven role for any of these other medications or other treatments that patients can have for heart failure. Basically, the people who just have pump problems and poor ejection fractions had more treatments available to them.
You've broken down that very nicely, Kathy. That's a lot of information, and the way that you've done it absolutely is relatable and makes sense. So can you discuss with us heart failure decompensation?
Okay, so heart failure exacerbations, basically precipitating factors for that. The treatment of common precipitants for heart failure exacerbations such as tachycardia or an abrupt severe elevation of systemic blood pressure, ischemia or atrial fib are important, but other conditions that may contribute to the exacerbation include infections, anemia, dietary indiscretion, medication noncompliance. Atrial fib is associated with a worse prognosis in heart failure and can exacerbate heart failure syndrome. So basically what they're talking about here is the fact that, you know, people, when they get into tachycardias or atrial fib, they increase their heart rate. So therefore their filling of that ventricle or that chamber also becomes decreased because the heart is not pumping, or it's pumping so fast that there's no time for that ventricle to fill in that diastolic phase of the heart contraction. So they're talking about rhythm control, but they feel that, you know, trying to control someone's rhythm, it doesn't improve cardiovascular outcome. And they feel, though, that sometimes in some patients who have heart failure reduced ejection fraction, who get into these tachyarrhythmias like atrial fib or flutter, may benefit from catheter ablation. Diuretics also must be carefully managed in the failing heart. Although both heart failure preserved ejection fraction, which is diastolic heart failure, and heart failure reduced ejection fraction, which is systolic heart failure, are very sensitive to excessive preload reduction, which happens with diuretic. The patient with heart failure preserved deserves a particular caution because of the nature of the stiff left ventricular, which becomes dependent on a higher filling pressure. So to maintain a forward flow. So when you over-diurese these people to excessive preload reduction, underfilling of that chamber, so the heart doesn't fill with volume of blood, so therefore the cardiac output into the system also falls. And, you know, this leads to worsening renal function, hypotension. And so for those reasons, venodilators such as nitrates and some calcium channel blockers, or otherwise known as CCBs, and diuretics must be administered with caution and close monitoring. Symptoms of ventricular underfilling and hypotension may include weakness, dizziness, and syncope. In addition, overdiuresis for both types of heart failure, preserved and reduced, can result in prerenal azotemia, which is, you know, the increasing BUN and creatinine, basically nitrogen's BUN in the system. Also, a common finding in our palliative care population is hypoalbuminemia, so a low albumin can affect diuresis and the effectiveness of the medications to promote fluid balance. So just because it binds to protein and it reduces the albumin further, resulting in larger extravascular space. So therefore we have more edema. They see, you know, the lower leg edema and ascites. So a slower rate of delivery to the kidneys also reduces, you know, urine output. So we really should be paying some attention to that also.
So are there any medications that should be avoided with heart failure patients?
Yes, there are. So one of them being NSAIDs, are non-steroidal inflammatory drugs. These drugs can cause vasoconstriction at the arterial level, and they can decrease the GFR and the sodium and water retention, all contribute to worsening fluid retention in patients with heart failure. So avoidance of NSAIDs in patients with heart failure is generally recommended. Similarly, corticosteroids can also worsen fluid retention in patients with heart failure. And this occurs through their mineral corticoid action, causing sodium and water retention. Corticosteroids should be used with caution in patients with heart failure at the lowest effective dose necessary. So dexamethasone also, which has a negligible mineral corticoid activity, may be most appropriate if the risk-benefit profile favors corticosteroid use. So amphetamines also, a central nervous system stimulant, methylphenidate, it also works by promoting the release of blocking norepinephrine and dopamine. So it works as a sympathetic nervous system and renin-angiotensin-aldosterone symptom. System, both the SNS as well as the closely associated renin angiotensin aldosterone system play major roles in the underlying pathology of heart failure and its progressive nature of increasing preload and afterload and promoting tachycardia and left ventricular hypertrophy. So it also increases SNS activity. It increases the risk of arrhythmias for patients with heart failure. As such, it's prudent to avoid these medications. and they are not recommended for patients with cardiovascular conditions, including ischemic heart disease and cardiomyopathies. Within the class of antiepileptics, both carbamazepine and pregabalin should also be used with caution. Carbamazepine has a negative inotropic and chronotropic properties that may exacerbate underlying myocardial dysfunction. Some psychotropic medications also should be avoided. Typical and atypical antipsychotic medications have been linked to cardiac complications, including cardiac arrhythmias and hypotension. Clozapine is known to cause myocarditis and cardiomyopathy, and it's thought to be secondary to immunoglobulin E-mediated hypersensitivity reaction. Tricyclic antidepressants are associated with numerous cardiac side effects. Tricyclic antidepressants have both a negative inotropic and pro-arrhythmic properties, which may be responsible for the case of cardiomyopathy. Reported with sertraline, though, was found to be safe in a randomized control study of patients with heart failure and depression. Similarly, venlafaxine is also not associated with an increased risk of cardiac events based on retrospective. They've also investigated antihyperglycemic medications. Glitazones have been associated with an increased rate of heart failure, and accordingly, several guidelines recommended against their use. There's also a number of chemotherapeutic agents have been found to have known cardiac side effects. So cyclophosphamides are associated with cardiomyopathies, and anthracyclines such as doxorubicin, daunorubicin, and epirubicin are linked to both acute toxicity and chronic progressive cardiomyopathy. Cyclophosphamides are associated with hemorrhagic pericarditis, pericardial effusions, and heart failure. In addition, targeted cancer therapies included trastuzumabs, like any of your MOBs, and there's one, sunitinib, are also linked with cardiomyopathy and should be avoided in those with established heart failure. 5-fluorocell is also known for cardiotoxic effects and most commonly linked with ischemic ischemia secondary to coronary vasospasm. It's also important to be aware that there are antimicrobials. This one really kind of blew my mind, because they interact with common heart failure medications to exacerbate heart failure. And so if patients are taking ACE inhibitors or ARBs or MRAs, Bactrim should be avoided or used with caution, as it has an elevated risk of hyperkalemia, acute kidney injury, and sudden death has been observed in patients treated with these medications. There's also, which kind of was interesting to me, because that is a very common antibiotic that people are treated with for urinary tract infection or sinus infection. I've even seen it used occasionally for patients who have some wounds. So I found that very interesting. So also there are antifungals. They're associated with increased edema, chest pain, hypertension, and cardiotoxicity, and are contraindicated in patients with left ventricular dysfunction and heart failure. So the underlying mechanism is not known, but has been proposed that it may have a negative inotropic effect. So CCBs, which are calcium channel blockers, they were one of the first heart drugs that I remember coming out. Verapamil and diltiazem came later. They should be avoided in patients with reduced left ventricular ejection fractions. So because of their negative, Canadian Cardiovascular Society guidelines recommend against the routine use of CCBs in patients with heart failure reduced ejection fraction. We should also note that natural remedies and some supplements should be considered. For example, ephedra, also known as Meiwang, which is a plant source for ephedrine, has been reported to provoke heart failure and exacerbations and left ventricular systolic dysfunction. So in addition, efforts should be made to also decrease sodium-containing preparations such as oral fleets. I don't know that we use oral fleets that much anymore. My understanding was people were not having those ordered, but this sort of points to the fact that we really should be doing good medication reconciliations out in the community for nurses who are in the community, just to make sure that they know all the medications patients are taking, especially those supplements that are often forgotten, that they're stuck in a cupboard somewhere else, not with their prescription meds.
That's an exhaustive list, Kathy. That's so much information. And not only is it valuable for nurses and healthcare professionals looking after people in the palliative care context, but also for health professionals working in intensive care units.
Mm-hmm. Like, I feel like, you know, I know that the palliative care unit probably at Toronto General Hospital or the university network, they probably apply more things. Like, they probably do use drugs that we would never look at using. But it is worth noting that it's kind of interesting. That
very beneficial to practice.
Yeah, like, we need to really understand that some of the drugs we use can affect these other drugs or potentiate them or create more problems for patients, which is not what we really want to do. Anyway. Exactly.
Yeah. So now, can we discuss some of the actual pharmacological treatments, their risks and benefits in heart failure patients, and maybe some of the drug interactions? And then could you also discuss some of the medication interactions used in the treatment of heart failure with some of the more commonly used palliative care medications?
Sure. So for heart failure medications and their effects and symptoms and function and class and exercise capacity and how they relate to quality of life for patients. So basically, the drugs that we do have at our disposal, which most of us are aware of, we have ACE inhibitors, which are enalapril, ramipril, lisinopril are ones that are familiar to us, ARBs, which are candesartan, belsartan, and losartan. We have ARNIs. This is a drug that is like a double drug, sacubitril, belsartan, and mineralocorticoid receptor antagonists, which is our mRNAs, which is spironolactone or pelironome. Beta blockers such as metoprolol and bisoprolol. We have another drug, which is a channel inhibitor, IF channel inhibitor. It's called ibabradine. This is not a medication that I have used. And then we also have SGLT2 inhibitors, which are your hypoglycemic medications used for diabetes, type 2 diabetes. And then again, we have inotropes and digoxin. They're talking about milrinone and dobutamine, which is a drug that we're not commonly using in the community. They also talked about vasodilators such as isozorbide and hydralazine combination there for patients, and diuretics such as furosemide. There's also torsemide. I've not really used torsemide, but I've heard about it. We also have metolazone added there. So basically, all of these drugs that are at the disposal of cardiologists to use for patients with heart failure are really found to only improve symptoms and function, like such as exercise capacity and improve the NYHA score for patients, only really work for patients who have heart failure reduced ejection fraction. Those are people with systolic heart failure and an ejection fraction that is less than 40%. Most of these meds, all of them, can be used in treating these patients. Also, it also improves their quality of life. The other flip side of that, for patients with heart failure with preserved ejection fraction, which is greater than 50%, who are elderly people with multiple comorbidities, really none of these drugs, except for ACE inhibitors, do have just symptom relief and exercise capacity. Really, what's at the disposal for these people who have preserved ejection fraction are just ACE inhibitors and really there's no other medication that is of benefit for them. And there's no proven role in any study that they have done regarding any of these medications for these patients. Really, the mRNAs actually do right across the board for both types of heart failure or both types of ejection fractions related to heart failure. mRNAs are the only drug that really right across the board for both of them actually is the only one that also is proven for patients with heart failure preserved ejection fraction. And basically, when we move on to all of these medications, so ACE inhibitors, basically, it affects, I'm talking about palliative care medications. So we do use things like duloxetine, antipsychotics. Nabilone has been ordered. It's not part of what we order, but it is something that has usually ordered in the community by the palliative care physicians. We use opioids, NSAIDs, amphetamines, sometimes, and pregabalin. So basically all of these medications that when in the presence of ACE inhibitors will cause hypotension. So we have to really monitor closely and pay attention. In fact, all of these drugs, ACE inhibitors, ARBs, mRNA, MRAs, beta blockers, inotropes, vasodilators such as your Isradil, and diuretics will all create hypotension in the presence of all of these drugs that we use, such as antipsychotics, nabilone, opioids, NSAIDs, pregabalin. They will all create hypotension. Most of the NSAIDs will also have renal dysfunction and increased hyperkalemia in the presence of ACE inhibitors. Same with ARBs will also create renal dysfunction and hyperkalemia, and it might diminish antihypertensive effects. Also, the MRAs have a renal dysfunction with hyperkalemia, and they also may diminish antihypertensive. Beta blockers, also, they will create for any of these in the presence of NSAIDs or corticosteroids and amphetamines. Well, NSAIDs and corticosteroids will, of course, increase your fluid retention in the presence of beta blockers and can, you know, exacerbate heart failure, and amphetamines may diminish antihypertensive effects. Now, this other drug, this IF channel blocker or channel inhibitor called ibibradine, this is one that I'm not familiar with. I've not seen used with any patients, but in the presence of our antipsychotics that we often use, such as haloperidol or quetiapine, it can cause a moderate to a high risk of QT interval prolongation. So that could cause sudden death in a patient. It can cause a malignant arrhythmia. Methadone and trazodone also have an indeterminate risk of QT interval prolongation. So in the presence of this particular drug, ibibradine. Last year, we had a gentleman in hospital who also, it was noted on his history that he had a prolonged QT interval. I believe when you have a prolonged QT interval, this can put you into a ventricular fib called Toussaint de Pointe, which is a type of ventricular tach where the points are turning. It's very, you can tell what it is when you see it on a monitor. We were trying to treat nausea for him. And of course, our drug of choice is haloperidol. And so it didn't matter what drug we looked at, even ondansetron, any of the antiemetics will all prolong QT intervals. So it was kind of a challenge to look after him and try to get his nausea under control. I think the doctors sort of basically started out slow with medications to treat him because he had hyperemesis. So he was in a bad way. But it was a real challenge for us to deal with that. So basically, all of these drugs, in the presence of all of the medications that we treat patients with, such as our antipsychotics, our opioids, our NSAIDs, most of them all cause problems for people with heart failure. Your NSAIDs and corticosteroids, again, fluid retention, and most of them cause hypotension, decreased blood pressure. So not that we're doing blood pressures often, but it is good to note that if we have people with heart failure, that we don't want to cause them more problems by giving them something or suggesting something and it's given and their blood pressure bottoms out.
Thank you for that story that's relevant to practice. It showed how your role as a nurse consultant for the palliative care network and looking at medications for palliative patient actually goes over into the realm of the medications and the tests and so on that they're using in intensive care units for these patients. So that's great information and good to know. So now that we've discussed the pharmacological treatments for heart failure patients, would you be able to tell us some of the non-pharmacological treatments that are used for these patients?
Yes. So other treatments are ICDs. So these are implantable devices and also that can pace or terminate or defibrillate to manage a life-threatening tachycardic arrhythmia, such as rapid ventricular tachycardia or ventricular fib. ICDs can prevent death from a lethal arrhythmia. However, ICDs do not improve cardiac function. They reduce heart failure symptoms or improve quality of life and can add burden, particularly if the ICD is discharging inappropriately. ICDs reduce the risk of sudden death. It may be may in essence increase the likelihood of a prolonged death from pump failure or a risk of hospital admission. So in contrast, pacemakers are used for bradycardias or atrioventricular blocks, such as our heart blocks. They provide electrical impulse to appropriately pace the heart. And cardiac resynchronization therapy with biventricular pacing is indicated in symptomatic patients with an ejection fraction of less than 35% and a wide QRS, and best better benefit it with people who have a bundle branch block. So decisions for ICD and pacemaker implantation and the discontinuation should be grounded in patients' beliefs and wishes around end-of-life care. So before they ever implant this device, such as an ICD or a pacemaker, it would be hoped that the cardiologist is talking to these people about what the conversations, such as implantation, but the conversation should be surrounded around the fact that, you know, when they're getting closer to end of life, I don't know if they've given them a prognosis. I'm sure they've told them somewhere between 2 and 5 years. And, you know, that these devices would need to be turned off at near end of life, and that do they understand all of that? There's also another device called an LVAD. It's a left ventricular assistive device. It's a mechanical pump. It originally was developed for people who were awaiting heart transplant, but it has improved in its efficacy, and it's not as difficult to use. They can implant them with the power source on the outside of the body. It used to be a pneumatic pump, and now it's more continuous flow pumps now. The risk factors for early mortality after an LVAD implantation include advancing age, whether their gender, usually female, obesity, renal dysfunction, and elevated bilirubin, and previous or need for concomitant cardiac surgery. So despite an improvement in quality of life and a decrease in heart failure symptoms with an LVAD, these people showed that they had a higher psychological distress after LVAD implantation, and LVADs had a significant impact on their caregiver burden. So it goes on to say that these people are set up basically for stroke, both hemorrhagic and ischemic. They have bleeding. Anyway, people with LVADs, you know, they may show that they're, you know, they improve their quality of life and they decrease their heart failure symptoms, but they also showed that LVADs patients in another study showed that they had a higher psychological distress after LVAD implantation, and that they had a significant impact on their caregiver burden. And they were also set up for stroke, both hemorrhagic and ischemic. They had bleeding, they developed arrhythmias, and the driveline exit site for this LVAD often became infected and are common causes of LVAD morbidity. So people did die of these complications from an LVAD. Cardiac rehab or exercise has also been found to reduce dyspnea and improve the endurance of quality of life in patients with heart failure. Oxygen apparently is not recommended as routine therapy in patients with hypoxemia. They prefer that they have supplemental oxygen only if should be provided if they have an SpO2 of less than 90%, but should not be withheld if it provides comfort for respiratory distress when comfort measures are the central goal. So sodium and fluid restriction, this was interesting. They did some studies with this that really basically they put people on these low sodium diets and fluid restrictions, and they found that there really was no change, that it didn't really matter whether they restricted their sodium or their fluids. So at 3 days, weight loss was similar in both groups of patients that were on low sodium and high sodium. And the residents, as was evidenced by clinical congestion, their thirst scale was significantly worse in the group with more restricted sodium and fluid intake. So basically, the restricted sodium group had a higher risk of death and heart failure hospitalizations, particularly in patients who were hyponatremic, had refractory heart failure. So it's reasonable to entertain that the cessation of sodium and fluid restriction when a patient's perceived quality of life is felt to be higher with unrestricted intake, despite potential hemodynamic consequences, a large randomized trial was done for heart failure is currently underway, but to definitively address this sodium restriction issue. So as far as what this is saying, there really was no difference in survival rates or preserving these people in heart failure with a sodium restriction or a fluid restriction. They go on to talk about ultrafiltration. I've never been involved with this treatment. It's basically ultrafiltration is safely achieved decongestion and reduces hospitalization for patients who are admitted with decompensated heart failure. Basically, it's to support patients who are in volume overload. So they did studies in advanced heart failure with variable outcomes. So therefore, it was not used routinely in the management of patients with heart failure, and routine use of ultrafiltration for the management of decompensated heart failure is not supported by the guidelines. So they did some studies with it, but it doesn't seem to be very useful.
So with these heart failure patients, I'm sure that it's very difficult when to use the palliative approach to care. Can you identify when to actually initiate the palliative approach to care for these patients?
Not really, but you wait for the referrals. I find I've had a couple of referrals recently, one of which he was end of life and went directly to hospice within 2 days of receiving that referral. And I had another referral recently, and he is also like stage four. He's probably like just maybe weeks to months away from death. So it is a real challenge to identify these people. You kind of wait for those referrals to come through for those kinds of people. But when they're in hospital, sometimes it's easier to approach the physician and say, do you think that this person might benefit? Unfortunately, even in hospital, we get those referrals late. People have been sitting over in ICU having, lots of treatments, or they're sitting on the floor somewhere. And unless I receive the referral for them, I'm not aware of them. And when I do get the referral, I'm kind of frustrated because they've been in the hospital for maybe 6 weeks and you could have been, able to get involved with them and sort of plan with them what their goals of care might be or how they feel about things with their disease process. But it is really difficult because it doesn't have a predictable illness trajectory. These people, have, peaks and valleys with exacerbations of congestive heart failure. And it's basically just catching them where you can when you're in the hospital or in community. But it's just basically going to be an education with physicians, I think, and nurse practitioners, I think, are probably a lot better at it, and nurses in our realm of care. But sometimes also for cardiologists, I don't know that they really look at it as a terminal disease as of yet. I think that specialists, they have a hard time letting go, and they are also very, dedicated to their field, and they want to do the best for the patient. So they're not really looking at end of life for them. They're looking more at the next treatment or how to make feel better. The biggest takeaway for me with this whole article is that the symptom management for the reduced ejection fraction people are the medications. All of these medications are their symptom management, especially with reduced ejection fraction. The other people, they, basically deserve support. I was listening to another presentation by a cardiologist who basically stated that patients who are discharged from hospital to hospice or to a palliative care unit have a life expectancy. They usually die within 11 days, as opposed to their counterparts of patients who have cancer who go to hospice may last much longer than that. Whereas people with heart failure, they're not, getting recognized soon enough and they're sent there. And some die within 3 days of admission to a hospice. So it sort of shows that we're a little bit behind the eight ball when it comes to recognizing this situation with patients with heart failure.
Every day in your practice as a nurse consultant, there are palliative care tools that you use when caring for your patients. Are there any of those palliative care tools that you would suggest would be beneficial in caring for patients with heart failure?
Yep. There are quite a few tools we can, given all the symptoms that these people have, they have every symptom under the sun. I feel like also the surprise question, I really feel that people who, they other presentations that I've listened to, and it's been documented here in this article, that the median survival rate for people with heart failure, doesn't matter which one it is, which kind of ejection fraction that they have is what I mean, whether they have systolic or diastolic heart failure, they all fall within a 2.1 year survival rate. So if you're going to be looking at these people or even approaching a physician about a client, you might say to them, you know, do you believe that this person will be alive in a year, or will this person be alive in 2 years? So it might be a way to help educate physicians to use the surprise question in their practice to think about this and maybe refer these people on a little earlier so that advanced care planning and goals of care can be addressed a little earlier on. All those things can change down the road, but at least people can start thinking about these things because they've often been told of what their survival rate is and that it is a terminal disease. And for people, especially with heart failure preserved ejection fraction, they have multiple comorbidities. So often it may not always be heart failure that they die from. They may die from something else, like their COPD or, you know, diabetes. They may have other issues that may take them away. Our Edmonton Symptom Assessment System tool, which would be very beneficial. These patients all exhibit every symptom that falls within our ESAS. So that is a beneficial tool to assess patients with. Palliative performance scale would also be very beneficial to see different transitions with these people. I think they would fit into that very nicely because they have a lot of problems with functional, with their exercise capacity and movement. I feel that PPS would be very applicable here. And many of these people that have heart failure preserved ejection fraction, they're elderly. Often they're that little lady who has multiple comorbidities. One of them just happens to be heart failure. They're often fall within that frailty. So we could do frailties. We could use our frailties tool. We can also use FICA for spiritual well-being. A lot of these people are depressed and are having some very, you know, decreased spiritual well-being and would require support in that manner. I really feel that palliative care would be really very beneficial for these people, and especially if they could be referred to us a little sooner than later.
Yes, because as we know, when they're referred earlier and sooner, their quality of life is much better.
Right.
What was true about this article in relation to your practice of palliative care?
Just basically what we've been talking about is the fact that they're not referred on early enough. Palliative care is not something that they think about when they are looking after a patient with heart failure. It's not thought to integrate that into the care of a patient who has heart failure. So to me, it was just true, like, that everything that was documented in here about patients being referred late to palliative care or not referred at all rang true. And basically that's because it is a challenge for physicians because they do not have a predictable course of illness. It's, you know, up and down. There's no inflection point with this disease trajectory. So it's hard for them to know when to refer on to a palliative care network, or not the network, but palliative care. They also know that, what was I going to say? I've lost my train of thought. I'm so sorry. But yeah, it's just basically that rang very true for me, that we're just not seeing these people until they're almost, you know, at end of life. I'm talking hours to days away from death is usually when we get the referral for heart failure patients.
Kathy, we're coming to the end of our time together, but before we go, can you quickly summarize some of the main highlights of this article?
Okay, so heart failure, it's a progressive disease. It's characterized by unpredictable disease trajectory. It's punctuated by episodic clinical exacerbations. Predicting future events and anticipating the transition of advanced disease states is difficult, and the median time from onset to symptomatic disease to death also varies. So there are two main causes of death in patients with heart failure. There's sudden death and progressive pump failure. Several commonly used palliative care medications may cause an acute exacerbation of heart failure are NSAIDs, anticonvulsants, and antipsychotics, and tricyclic antidepressants. Many heart failure medications lead to the improvement of mortality, function, symptom burden, and health-related quality of life for patients with heart failure, reduced ejection fraction. Few heart failure medications appear to do this for patients with heart failure, preserved ejection fractions. So a common pharmacodynamic drug interaction of concomitant heart failure and palliative care medications use is hypotension. The aggressive diuresis is often necessary to manage fluid overload, although this can be associated with worsening renal failure. It rapidly improves symptoms. Excessive volume contraction through diuresis should be avoided in patients with heart failure preserved ejection fraction, as this can contribute to ventricular underfilling, so that we aggressively, excessive volume contraction, meaning we've diuresed them quite aggressively. And so that heart, it contracts down and the muscle is quite stiff. So it's hard for it to fill that ventricle. It fills late. It's, remember, it's diastole, where that filling phase is of heart volume, volume of fluid that into the heart. So, and this results in hypotension, weakness, dizziness, syncope, and cardiovascular collapse at times. ICDs can prevent death from lethal arrhythmias. However, ICDs do not improve cardiac function or reduce heart failure symptoms. ICD shocks can worsen quality of life and may also increase the likelihood of a prolonged death from pump failure. Consideration should be given to the deactivation toward the end of life. So, in summary,
Kathy, I want to thank you for taking this very complex article and breaking it down and making it relevant to everyday practice for healthcare professionals who work with patients in palliative care. You did an absolutely fantastic job of that. So thank you for joining me today.
Thank you very much. It was a pleasure.
And perhaps in the future, this would be some information that we could use as another education session
for sure
for the network. It was really good. Thank you. Thank you so much, Kathy.
Thank you.